Welcome to Unboxing Queer History, a podcast from Gerber Hart Library and Archives. Gerber Hart is an independent, nonprofit library and archives with collections that focus on the LGBTQ plus history of Chicago and the Midwest. This season was made possible by a Broadening Narratives grant from the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and by support from listeners like you. Thank you. Today, we hear from Michaela Floto about grassroots archiving and how it can fight against erasure and archival silences.
Was the year I moved to Chicago to pursue a master's in museum and exhibition studies. Academia proved to be frustrating and disappointing for me at times, but whenever I had the chance to learn queer histories, the research always brought me back in. For my capstone project, I conducted a small collection of oral histories related to Black LGBTQ nightlife in Chicago, and I named it the Lavender Noir Project.
At that time, Old Town was the spot to be.
This episode is a love letter to the guardians of our history, the grassroots archivists.
But sometimes people tend to think of me in a very, like, pedestal way, and I don't get to be a human being. And I think that it's heightened because I'm Black. And they said, it's not that it's what you're doing is extraordinary. A lot of white people think it's extraordinary coming from you, a Black person.
In only 4 short months, I interviewed DJs, event organizers, drag performers, and attendees about Black LGBTQ nightlife in Chicago, who share their stories from as early as the 1960s to as recent as 2024.
Some spaces I remember on the South Side, some which still exist, like the Jeffrey Pub, Club Escape, The Taste used to be a spot that we would go to occasionally on a Sunday.
You get asked to perform in the months of like Black History Month or Juneteenth shows, and then that's it. And, you know, we just want to show that you can have more than one performer of color in a show. Like, you can have a full show all the time of performers of color. Like,
Black populations in the U.S. face one of the shortest life expectancies. Therefore, I felt a strong sense of urgency, knowing already how many Black stories have been lost and how many stories have been overlooked. Because of this saturation of white history in queer archives, a myth prevails that white, cis, gay history is the canon, and every other community's history is attached to that narrative and that timeline. I chose nightlife as the focus for Lavender Noir because there is so much joy and resistance in the spaces we create when we were and are sidelined and forced to make our own spaces. And when I think of all the stories from the Black queer people I've met and recorded, I know they deserve more than to be a footnote to mainstream history. In the last episode, we heard from a few people managing LGBTQ archives about how they, as institutions, were reconciling with the gaps in their collections, such as programming, partnerships, and outreach. In this episode, I will introduce you to the ways in which people like me took it into their own hands to fill the silences in historical archives outside of institutions. Last time, we were introduced to Lou Nienberg and Caitlin Griffith, who in March 2025 held an archive party in collaboration with Gerber Hart.
Lavender Night, the name comes from a playoff of Ladies Night, but we want something for trans people, so that's why it became NB Night. But it's not just for non-binary people, it's for trans people, and most importantly, it's for trans curious people. We like to have something to do besides just be at a bar and drinking. Mm-hmm. So there's always something going on when we do an NB Night. This one we're doing an archive party, so Gerber Hart is bringing out things from their archive for our community to look at so we can see how trans history has been preserved and how important it is to preserve that. And we're also inviting people to come and bring things to add to the archive, making a complete timeline of, you know, the history of trans people.
Everything that is donated today will go straight to the Dorothy Living Archive Project, stewarded by Gerber Hart volunteer Caitlin Griffith.
We're doing a capsule year of audio, mostly audio visual recording of events at Dorothy, specifically performances.
It sort of started around the time of, like, when a lot of attention was being paid to how few lesbian bars there are, and also sort of at the tail end of the first round of drag bans, and those two things sort of, like, push forward this idea of preserving the queer performance.
We rarely have the resources or hindsight to begin recording history as it happens, which makes this project so special. I asked Caitlin, what would be their ideal outcome of that evening's event?
I'm hoping that we get some zine contributions from non-binary folks tonight. We have like a DIY station where people can make their own zines. We brought zines from the archive for people to take inspiration from. Yeah, and hope that people write about their lives and their frustrations and their hopes. I hope that this can serve as a model for Gerber Heart and collections like it, so that we can like proactively collect instead of waiting for an institution to close and then sort of picking up what's left behind. Yeah. Because, you know, the AV recordings are never left behind.
Queer archive parties are a great way to get the community involved in historical preservation. However, they still vary. In a segregated Chicago, it may still be hard to reach an entirely inclusive audience. I asked the host of MB Night, Lou, about the demographics of Dorothy.
A lot of bars, a lot of lesbian bars have a history of not being inclusive of people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly just prioritizing white women.
Mm-hmm.
And not even acknowledging that, just they're not even realizing who they're missing out on. And so I've noticed that myself, and I've tried to do everything I can to put people of color at the forefront of what we're doing.
I wondered how different a historical project could look based on its location and regular demographic, and how that may influence how we see queer spaces, queer community, and queer history in the future. Caitlin said that she was inspired by an iconic performance from the late drag performer Tandy Iman Dupree.
How many performances like that are we missing? Yeah. That, like, do we just not get to see?
Tandy Iman Dupree's performance took place at the Miss Gay Black America pageant in 2001 in Tennessee. And the video of the performance shows an empty stage as the song Holding Out for a Hero by Bonnie Tyler begins to play. And someone dressed as Superman crosses the stage, searching for someone. And then from the ceiling, Tandy drops into the splits, onto the stage, dressed as Wonder Woman, and begins her performance. A video of the performance was uploaded to YouTube in 2009 and went viral. And it's considered to be one of the greatest entrances of all time. Tandy would never know of how successful her performance would become. Tandy passed away due to AIDS-related complications in 2005 at the age of 27. I'm grateful someone filmed her performance that day. And when I first saw that video on YouTube, I wanted to know and see more about Tandy. But a quick search only came up with the same video. I just wish we had an interview with Tandy Iman, and maybe even more footage of her iconic performances. However, her legacy is kept alive by her drag lineage and chosen family. The night that performance took place, two people made history. Tandy for her iconic performance, and the person on the other side of the camera, who made it possible for us to experience that moment with them.
Here Everywhere is, I kind of call it like a podcast slash mapping project, because like, I really got interested in like mapping and like seeing where things are.
If you haven't heard about We Are Everywhere, We Are Everywhere is a mapping and oral history project created by Francia Stevenson. The project highlights the stories of trans and non-white individuals, communities, and spaces. Francia interviewed elders in Chicago to create a map detailing Chicago's LGBTQ+ community spaces throughout the years. Francia first got involved with the Intergenerational Dialogue Project, a local project that builds relationships and opportunities to hear from our LGBTQ+ elders and learn their stories.
I chose five different elders, most of which were from the LGBTQ+ dialogue, Intergenerational Dialogue Project, and I focused on like elders of color and trans elders.
Francia started this project in graduate school to explore Chicago's queer spaces, as well as the communities that we form both with and without tangible locations.
I started interviewing these elders, and I started asking about spaces that were meaningful, thinking about how we're not just in one location. That's kind of why I called it We Are Everywhere, but the idea of We Are Everywhere is that LGBTQ community can and will exist everywhere in all different neighborhoods.
And Frenzy would actually visit a lot of the places they learned about through their interviews.
Thing I found a lot is a lot of times bars operated not just as a bar but also a community space, especially I found like in the In the suburbs, a lot of, like, the suburban bars became kind of, like, community spaces that kind of crossed all those, like, boundaries of, like, race, gender, like, different, like, income levels. I actually got to visit one of the bars mentioned in my podcast called Crave, and that bar had been around for, like, 100 years as a gay space, so.
Francia learned about not only permanent spaces, but some traveling parties, such as Executive Suite. Francia interviewed Juarez Hawkins about her experience as an attendee.
Executive Suite, for those who don't know, is like a traveling kind of like party for like Black queer women.
I got to hear part of Francia's conversation with Juarez.
Pat McCombs and Vera Washington, kind of this pair, started Executive Suite. It was like just these sort of semi-private parties, like primarily for Black lesbians. And so, you know, you could, you know, again, once you were in the know and on the secret mailing list, you get like pluggers for their parties. They have really cool little boat parties and stuff. They rent a boat. You know, I never felt like there would be any problems. I mean, like, for one, you know, they had parties on a boat in the middle of Lake Michigan. Who's coming out there? It's like, you're going to swim all the way out there to come and get at us.
During our interview, I asked Francia what was their definition of space.
A lot of, like, my queer upbringing was kind of online through, like, Tumblr. And I think a lot of us, maybe, like, younger people, that's something completely, you know, foreign to some of the older generation. But it is, like, online stuff can also be a community, you know. Other spaces that I really like to focus on, such as, like, bathhouses, those kind of have really fun to explore those, bookshops and, like, coffee shops, also spaces for, like, people who don't, you know, drink, or, like, sober spaces are super important.
For many of us, our immediate reference for queer spaces are bars, but there are so many other ways to come together. Francia collects more than interviews.
I have a pin from the AA Meat Market, which was a leather bar in the 80s. I have a pin from Gay Chicago's Fantasy Crew. I have a pin from Horizons. My idea is to one day have, like, a little archive of my own that other people can use.
It was really exciting to interview Francia, because when I started my project, I attended an online teach-in held by Gerberhart, where Francia was presenting. I reached out, and it was Francia who introduced me to organizations and physical spaces to begin my research on Black queer nightlife. Francia's work with We Are Everywhere is a great example of how you can make a lasting impact on LGBTQ+ history while prioritizing non-white history. If you would like to see the map and learn more about this project, listen to the podcast at We Are Everywhere Chicago. Archiving can also be done by grassroots organizations like the Gage Park Latinx Council. I spoke with a member who played a key part in their grassroots archiving efforts.
My name is Antonio Santos, he, him, his pronouns. I'm a co-founder of the Gage Park Latinx Council, as well as I currently serve as the executive director. GPLXC was formed in 2018, partially as a response to the hostility of the current administration then and now, unfortunately, really going after queer and Mexican identities. And it started as a group of neighbors coming together to kind of combat some of the threats that we were seeing around ICE and immigration coming into our communities, but also to create spaces for queer people to exist within a majority Latino community.
Antonio was well-versed on the history of the Gage Park neighborhood.
So Gage Park was historically a European immigrant community, and then there was integration when Dr. King came here to the Gage Park High School to raise awareness of the fact that there was integration. And then there was a lot of white flight and divestment, which is where we get here today. And it seems that, like, a lot of the stories just stopped being recorded after white flight.
So as soon as the neighborhood lost its white population, the history onward didn't seem to matter anymore. Hearing this was frustrating, but not surprising.
And so we knew that we should be documenting our work and the stories of the people that we were collaborating with and giving those stories a space to live so that if gentrification were to happen here, we would have photos and videos and audio of the people who have called this place home since the 60s.
Like the Dorothy Living Archive Project, this is a self-archiving effort anticipating erasure and record keeping. However, the Gage Park Latinx Council is anticipating gentrification and the key role historical erasure plays in that process.
For me, when I was interested in learning about LGBTQ history, a lot of the perspectives came from white cis men. A lot of the books, a lot of the articles. I was just always wondering, like, what other folks were doing at the same time. What were black folks doing? What were Latina folks doing? What were women doing? And I think that created a lot of curiosity to engage in the history from a non-traditional way. Like, maybe I couldn't find that information within books that were published, but then, you know, there are zines, there are podcasts, there are oral histories.
I asked Antonio about the Gage Park Latinx Council's work with the Chicago History Museum.
Yeah, so the Chicago History Museum was one of those institutions that when we went looking for Gage Park history, there just didn't exist anything outside of police brutality and the white flight. And at the same time, there were students from a school who were protesting the fact that there was no representation of Latina folks at the History Museum. Despite being one third of the city's population, like, there was not one exhibit about us. And so we started working with the museum, taking youth from our programs there to do like critical museum visits, to analyze their collections and for us to fill the gaps within our own program.
And this was a part of the Key in Chicago project.
And so those youth spent the summer conducting oral histories and taking photographs and putting on an exhibition about who resides in Gage Park, who has built Gage Park, and how queer folks also fit into that narrative, which again, I think when you're from, when you have more than one identity, it's very easy for it to be erased within. You either have to choose to go into like queer spaces or Latino spaces, and there wasn't really a lot we saw within our community where those things overlapped.
As someone who wasn't introduced to queer history until the age of 18, I was particularly intrigued by their youth-centered program, Queer Riot.
So Queer Riot is a program that I started. I used to work at the Gender and Sexuality Center at UIC, and it was a really great space for students to get involved in LGBTQIA+ history and activism. But I also know that most people from our community don't access higher education. And so I wanted to make that information accessible to high school students. That may or may not go into a field that looks into gender studies, and really make it accessible and normalized within our community.
This project is a great example of how self-archiving facilitates agency when it comes to documenting our stories outside of academic institutions.
So we cover the history of queer organizing in the United States from 1890 to 1990 with a POC view. These histories that earlier we were talking about are harder to find, and make that information more digestible and accessible for high school youth through an internship that is also paid. And then the second part of the internship, after they learn about queer history, is we provide them with a stipend to then produce their own youth queer-led programs and initiatives.
The Queer Riot participants conducted their own research, curated exhibitions, and planned programming that centered queer youth. This sounded like something a six-year-old me would have definitely benefited from. It warmed my heart knowing that the Gage Park Latinx Council was training future and current grassroots archivists, and just how long-lasting that impact would have.
How would you recommend grassroots archivists, everyday people, go about partnering with larger historical institutions or even smaller ones like Herbert Hart?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that worked out for us, and I don't know that it will work out at every institution, is naming the injustice. I think that a lot of these institutions are ready to reckon with the fact that historically they have left out certain communities, and offering them a pipeline to fixing that problem. So it's not just the criticism of your archive is very white. It's your archive is very white, and here is a way in which you can support black and brown people who are already doing this work, and use your institutional power and platforms to give them the recognition that they deserve. And so for us, it was very important when we were partnering with the Chicago History Museum and Gerber Hart that we maintained ownership of everything that they used, which is not how museums normally work. Normally you sign over ownership and they take it into their archive. We wanted the information to be accessible as a learning tool, but we did not need these institutions to own or house the stories that our youth have been collecting for many years now.
Antonio really emphasizes the power of the individual and community when it comes to record keeping by demystifying the role of historical institutions and reclaiming agency.
Especially as you were talking about, I think an experience that we both had where we were like being introduced to this work and not seeing ourselves. All the work that you talked about, all the work that you've done, 50 years from now, what is your hope that how this like content will be received and the impact it will have on the community?
Yeah, I think most importantly is like 50 years from now, people will know that we existed within this space, that we existed within communities that aren't outwardly queer presenting. Somebody will be looking back to wonder exactly how I wondered when I was younger. Like, I wonder what queer people were doing during the pandemic. I wonder how queer people helped to step up in times of social unrest or social injustice or attacks from this administration. And I think for us, all of that has been really clearly documented so that we can show exactly what we were doing when shit hit the fan. And people won't have to wonder what Latinos, and in particular Latinos from Gage Park, were doing during those times.
Antonio named the issues within present-day historical record-keeping so clearly while providing a detailed understanding of how grassroots organizations and archivists could work with institutions to create more inclusivity and assert our voices and existence into that narrative which has admitted us.
Yeah, it's been a very tumultuous journey for us. We started during the first Trump administration, then organized through COVID to help save lives in our community, and now a second Trump administration. And so part of it feels like we can't catch a break in society as organizers. But we know that what we have learned is a need for flexibility.
In the last episode, we talked about how a second Trump administration was impacting LGBTQ archives and cultural institutions. This moment's attack on LGBTQ and BIPOC communities isn't the first time we've been faced with systemic erasure. Many well-known queer historical archives and collections began as grassroots projects themselves, such as the GLBT Historical Society's founding in the midst of the AIDS epidemic. They were acts of preservation and survival. The grassroots archives of today could become the most used libraries of tomorrow. For this podcast, I interviewed 9 people. Throughout all of them, every single person emphasized the same feeling that drove them to do their work because of this moment. And it's that they're trying to erase us.
They're trying to rewrite and eradicate history. Lucky for us, queer history, and particularly queer history from a BIPOC lens, has always kind of been erased. And so we are already used to having to be the guardians of that history and the storytellers for our community. And so I think that we are well prepared to continue that legacy. Unfortunately, if we look at history, queer history has always been under attack. Queerness in public has always been under attack. And so it's not too much different than it was in the past. We know the importance of underground spaces and zines and oral histories and personal archives. And I think that we are really well equipped to protect those stories until we live in a country in which those stories can be celebrated and put into public spaces. We will continue to do it publicly within our community, even as the government tries to make it harder and harder nationally.
Yeah, I hope this project and projects like this encourage people to think about historical preservation. Think about their own lives as history and think about like how small the barrier is to that preservation. It's insisting on the truth. There is no truth without queer history. There's no history without queers.
And that's why this work is so important and why it's important that we include everyone's voice. I took Antonio's advice on how to work with larger institutions. Over the summer, I met with Gerber Hart to discuss the future of the Lavender Noir Project and Gerber Hart's lack of diversity in the collections. The following recordings are from August 4th, 2025. We are hosting a fundraiser to raise money for an internship to continue the Lavender Noir project at Gerber Heart. The DJs booked that night, All the Way K and Tori the Creator, were interviewed by me over a year ago, so having them there made this night really special. Gerber Heart is set up with a table in the back, taking donations for the archive and displaying items related to Black queer history from their collection, a collection that will only grow from here.
We have so many people's individual stories, organizational histories, board games, queer comics and zines, you got it. So we are here for you. We want to do everything we can to continue to preserve queer history. Now more than ever, it's very, very important to make sure that we keep these stories alive and accessible.
That night, we raised $1,500 toward a stipend for someone to continue my passion project from 2024. Grassroots archiving could be something really small. You don't need a degree or an institution to preserve history, and you don't need a degree to be a historian. Activism looks different for everyone, and it can look like recording conversations with your best friend or saving flyers from a night out at a bar. In a world that is trying to erase us, every act of preservation is important, because all of our history matters.
This episode was produced by Akilah Floto and edited by Mara Laser and Anna Mason. Unboxing Queer History Season 2 is co-created by Aaron Bell and Jendon Till. Special thanks to the Gaylord and Dorothy Dolly Foundation for providing major funding for this season and for the support of listeners like you. To learn more about how you can support the preservation of our collections and help us continue unboxing queer history, visit gerberheart.org. Next time, join us as Hannah Vitti explores queer spirituality in Gerber Heart's collections and in Chicago.